David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 136 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm, or download the program afterwards as a podcast. You can also listen to any of the last 5 episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. You will be responsible for any long-distance charges. This week is a special offer. The first person to write in with a comment on the show will receive a copy of the book, The XX Factor, by Alison Wolfe, one of my former guests. Currently, you can donate via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.php or patreon.com/theinfectiousmyth if you want to make monthly donations. Even a dollar a month helps. If every one of my listeners gave me a dollar a month, I would be free to devote a lot more time to the show. I appreciate you listening, commenting, and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. This week, I deliberately made the interview a little bit shorter so that we could go through some of the feedback that's been bottled up for the last little while. Celia Farber wrote about her own episode, number 132. Thank you, David Crowe, for being liberal in the true sense of opening up space for discussions with people who see things differently. Many of us are cracking apart in these toxic, polarized days. It's precious when people on opposite sides can talk. And you run an excellent podcast. Will, via email, said, I loved your interview with Celia Farber. Regarding the Terry Michael interview on PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, which was number 133, John on Facebook wrote, thanks, David, great informative interview with Terry Michael. I heard somewhere that Gallo is not on the same page with Fauci on PrEP. Can it be because he's not making money with it? Roger via Facebook wrote, in Canada's First Nations, they are characterized as a risk group for HIV and AIDS, which is as racist and neo-colonial as characterizing black people as such, isn't it? Donald on Facebook wrote, just listen to the show as a download from PRN. You and Terry Michael had a very entertaining conversation about PrEP and politics. I learned a lot. Edwin via Facebook wrote, thank you, David, for the link. That's good journalism. Way back at the David Stephan interview, which was numbers 126 and 7, it was a doubleheader. I received a comment, and I'm afraid I can't remember the person who wrote this. Excellent interview. I wonder if the health and justice systems will ever admit their role in the death of David Stephan's son. Sounds like the health authorities have agendas which are impediments to their ability to exercise integrity, authenticity, and responsibility. I do hope the justice authorities are brave enough to ensure that justice is served. A long and detailed comment from Mindy on the Shaken Baby Syndrome episode with a lady that we called Mary. That was episode 135. I found this talk fascinating. I recall hearing about Shaken Baby Syndrome on an episode of Quincy MD, and like everyone, I thought that the symptoms must back up the idea of a baby dying from being violently shaken to death. Mary was informative on various genetic problems, undiagnosed, resulting in false accusations or prosecutions. And thank you, David, for mentioning adverse events from vaccines causing similar symptoms to shaken baby syndrome, or just resulting in the sudden infant death of babies. Who knows if a parent might have been accused of shaken baby syndrome when it was a vaccine causing the death 1 or 2 days or a week later. I do want to encourage your guest, Mary, and other listeners to do research on the history of vaccinations and their ingredients and the effects on the body, and look for independent, peer-reviewed, placebo-controlled studies proving effectiveness of any vaccine. I challenge anyone to do that, since none have ever been found. Advocating parents of healthy babies to follow the vaccine schedule is a very dangerous recommendation without having knowledge of the things I've mentioned. Everyone should know these things before either vaccinating their child or themselves. Informed consent, That is what we really should be recommending. Thanks for another interesting show. I wanted to briefly comment on the incredible healthcare debate in the United States that ended, at least for now, with the withdrawal of the Republican AHCA to replace the Affordable Care Act. And although the Affordable Care Act can be legitimately criticized because it's nowhere near as fair as a single-payer system, it did allow people with pre-existing conditions to get insurance. It did expand by many millions of people the number who had insurance. What was incredible about the debate was that Republicans seemed to be placing the ability to give a tax break to rich people above people's ability to get insurance. And there was this incredible belief that if they could only remove the government from healthcare, that prices of insurance would go down. And given how much insurance companies like gouging people, selling them expensive insurance that actually doesn't cover what they need, the Republicans seem to be living in a dream world. What would it mean to get the government out of health insurance? I mean, American government programs spend a lot of money on health insurance. There's Veterans Affairs, there's Medicare, there's Medicaid. Imagine a homeless guy gets hit by a car and is lying in the road. He's going to die if he doesn't get a blood transfusion, if they don't stop the bleeding, if they don't repair the damaged bones. There's going to be no chance of him getting back on his feet, literally, if he doesn't get follow-up, including probably pain drugs and physiotherapy. In a purely capitalist system, the best thing to do would be to let him die on the side of the road, because nobody's going to want to pay for the health care for a guy who's got nothing. But that's not the way it is in the United States. He will get picked up by an ambulance that knows they're not going to get reimbursed by the guy lying on the street, and he'll be taken to an emergency room, and he'll be patched up and then sent out without getting everything he should get. But America's certainly not heartless enough to let people die on the side of the road, which proves that government is needed in the healthcare system. And America, if you only care about money, would go for a single-payer healthcare system. I looked up some statistics in a 2012 article by two U.S. academics and one foreign. At the time in the late 90s, when Canada was paying $2,300 approximately per person per year for healthcare, America was paying $4,000, 9.5% of the GDP in Canada, 13.6% in the United States. Life expectancy in Canada is better for males, 76 years versus 74 in the U.S., and for females, 81 years versus 79 in the United States. And infant mortality in Canada is only 5.5 versus 7.2 in the United States. Mike Adams of Natural News, who publishes some really good things on health, but I think goes over the edge on some of his conservative views. At one point, he actually simulated a mass shooting at a university in Texas to push the idea that what we really need on campuses, where you have a lot of young people consuming drugs and dealing with stress, being out on their own for the first time in their lives, what you really need is guns to prevent mass shootings. He gave five criticisms of the Affordable Care Act. It's unaffordable. There's been massive increases. There's no choice in insurance companies. The co-ops are exploding. And Medicare, which was intended for poor people, has been expanded to people who aren't quite so poor. It is more expensive than it should, point number one, but it's nowhere near as expensive as the Republican system. There have been increases in insurance, but they're nowhere near the increases, especially for elderly people, that would have occurred with the Republican system. There's no choice in insurance companies. I don't know really if that makes a big difference in here in Canada, for example, and in other industrialized countries. You don't have a choice. You have the insurance is paid for by the government, and nobody really complains about that. But you do have a choice of doctors, more choice, actually, than in the United States. I can go to any doctor is taking patients in Canada, whereas in the United States, I may have to stay within the list of doctors provided by my insurance company. The fourth criticism was that co-ops are exploding, and yes, they were set up to fail because they're competition to the insurance companies. His comment on Medicaid being intended for poor people and now being expanded to people who are still extremely poor, I just thought was heartless. And that's what I've noticed in a lot of the Republican debate, is an incredible amount of heartlessness, as well as stupid comments like, I'm a man, I don't want to pay for mammograms. Well, as a critic of the healthcare system, I don't think we should have mammograms for most women unless they're particularly at risk for breast cancer. But when you buy insurance, or when you pay, you may need to pay some monthly fees in some provinces in Canada, and other provinces there's no fees at all. You're not saying, well, I'm a man, so I'm not going to need this and I'm not going to need that, or I'm a woman, so I'm not going to need this or that. Obviously, everybody has different healthcare needs, and hopefully most people in their lifetime don't have very many health crises. Some people are going to be faced with a lifetime full of crises, and they're going to take a lot out of the system. And other people like me, so far, touch wood, have never had a major health crisis, so I pay in through my taxes and I don't take out. The benefit is I'm healthy, and I'm okay having an insurance program in Canada where if I'm riding my bicycle and I get hit by a bus, somebody will pick me up, put me in an ambulance, take me to the hospital, and patch me up as best they can, and I won't get a bill at the end of it. Today, Desmond Mead is a man with a law degree in Florida working to restore the rights of about 1.7 million former felons to vote. He didn't take the easy way to get here. He is one of those 1.7 million. After being thrown out of the army for stealing liquor, he returned to Miami and there was convicted of several drug charges and then for having a firearm, another privilege that felons lose. After his release, he was homeless. But he didn't give up. He completed a drug treatment program, then graduated in paralegal studies from Miami College, and then entered Florida International University Legal School, from which he graduated in 2014. As a former felon, he is not allowed to practice law in Florida, but rather than move to a state where this would be allowed, he decided to fight for the rights of ex-felons in Florida, particularly the right to vote. Welcome to the show, Desmond.
Thank you for having me, David.
And did I get your background correct?
Yeah, that seems about right. Yeah.
It's maybe not the standard background, but I mean it's interesting because it says a lot to me about the idea that maybe seems somewhat old-fashioned now, the sort of the idea of redemption, that people can do bad things in their lives and then they can work to overcome that.
Most definitely. I mean, I always remember this quote by George Bush about America being a nation of second chances, you know, and I think back to when this country was first formed, you know, it was the people from England who looked for a second chance, you know, and that's what this country is all about. I think it's at the root of the nature of who we are as Americans, as human beings, actually.
It seems that the system currently is set up that when you get convicted of a felony, which I guess, I don't know if every country uses that term, but a serious enough crime, you basically lose a ton of stuff, and sometimes for the rest of your life. Now let's talk, you're working really hard on the issue of voting, so... And you have an organization that...
The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition.
Right. And so before we talk about what that organization is doing, is why do you feel that the right to vote is significant for ex-felons considering all the other things that they lose?
Well, that's a great question, David. And the reason why we're particularly focusing on the right to vote is because there is no other quality that speaks to citizenship more than voting. You know, when a person loses their civil rights, they, you know, not only lose the right to vote, but they lose the right to serve on the jury, they lose the right to run for office, they lose, they have collateral consequences that would prevent them from having getting safe and affordable housing or even employment, like in my case. But there's none of those qualities other than voting that really strikes at the heart of what being an American citizen is all about.
Right. And, I mean, there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says, well, at least, I mean, I'm not an expert, I'm not even American, I'm Canadian, but there seems to be nothing in the Constitution that says you can lose your citizenship if you go to jail, and yet not being able to vote is basically losing your citizenship, right?
Yes, I'm pretty much. But once you, and not even necessarily go to jail, but once you're convicted of a felony offense, you, in essence, lose your at least part of your citizenship, and you're relegated to second-class citizenship status. I think it's important, though, for people to understand that, you know, when you look at mass incarceration in the United States, and we all know that, you know, America is really bad with you know, the amount of citizens it incarcerates, it's very important to know that there are three times as many people who are convicted of felony offenses that don't go to prison, you know.
That's really interesting. I'd never actually thought about that. So by that, you mean you might get a suspended sentence, you might get immediate parole, something like that?
Probation, yes, yes. You know, particularly here in Florida, approximately 170,000 people each year are convicted of felony offenses. And of those people, less than 25% are even sentenced to prison. You know, and so, I mean, where are these other 75%? You know, they're in our community, they're in our homes, they're in our congregation. You know, and so many times we focus so much on the incarcerated individual, we fail to realize that even those individuals that were not incarcerated are facing the same hurdles. You know, there's no difference between either one when it comes to the loss of civil rights or the ability to get them back.
Another thing in America is the whole business of pleading guilty. I mean, most people would think, well, you plead guilty when you did the crime. But I think especially in America, this is probably true everywhere, is that if you plead guilty, you're usually offered a deal. And the implication or the overt threat is if you don't plead guilty and you go to trial and you get convicted, your sentence is going to be much worse than that. So if you're offered like 2 years or 2 months by pleading guilty and you're threatened with 10 years or 10 months if you go to trial, then a lot of people will plead guilty. But what's the consequences of pleading guilty versus going to trial and potentially getting innocent?
Well, it's important to recognize that the American judicial system is only fair in name purposes, not in nature. The nature of our judicial system is definitely not fair, and you brought up a real good example of how people are coerced or forced to plead guilty just for the fear of not having to do, you know, extremely long sentences. And so in the case, I've been involved in a case personally where I was not guilty of something that I was charged of. I did not do what I was accused of doing. Mm-hmm. But I knew that if I did not plead guilty or plead no contest and were to challenge it, that I could face probably upwards of 10, 15 years in prison. And so when they offer an opportunity for me to be released immediately if I plead guilty, I took that opportunity because it's a crapshoot in the judicial system.
And another thing, I remember there was a case, there was a guy in New York who was charged with stealing a backpack, and he said he didn't do it, and it seems from the evidence after that he didn't do it. But because he refused to take a deal, refused to plead guilty, he was kept in pre-trial custody at Rikers Island in New York City for over a year, I believe, which is another thing that's used against people who don't want to plead guilty. If you plead guilty, even if you have to spend time in jail, that's counting, the time's counting down. But if it's pretrial custody, it can go on for a long time.
Yeah, and it definitely takes on some of the characteristics of back in the slavery, time of slavery, when, you know, you had a slave that attempted to escape and he was caught and he was punished, right, and he was whipped. He wasn't whipped in private. He was whipped in front of other slaves to demonstrate to them that if they tried to do so, what would happen to them. And so when you have people like this young man that unfortunately end up taking his life, when other people, other inmates, see how he was treated by claiming innocence or trying to allow our justice system to actually work through the process, when they see what happened to him, then they're being in essence being told that, listen, you take the plea deal. Because if you don't, you might get the same treatment that he got.
Yes. Does this, in Florida, are prosecutors and judges elected?
So, in some cases. So, on a trial level, trial court level, judges are definitely elected. When you get to the appellate, farther than the appeal process, so our District Court of Appeal judges, they're appointed, as well as our Supreme Court justices. As far as individual prosecutors, each county has a designated prosecutor that is an elected position.
And does this move, motivate prosecutors to get lots of convictions? I mean, does that come up in elections? Like, I'm tough on crime, I put so many people in jail. Is this a factor?
Well, I think that is something that has been in our system for quite some time, especially in our political system, that there's this narrative about being tough on crime, and it's just only a superficial narrative. It's not an intelligent narrative because, you know, being tough on crime really means you should be smart on crime. And being smart on crime would have really have prevented us from, you know, enacting a lot of policies or laws that were really detrimental to our country, detrimental to the system, and does nothing to reduce crime in our community. But, you know, when you get into this tough on crime narrative, you basically are forcing politicians to be more reactionary to the emotional state of mind of the public, as opposed to really being thoughtful and methodical in the process of reducing crime or increasing public safety.
And, I mean, it always strikes me that if being tough on crime worked, then we would see less and less crime. And I suppose the crime rate is actually going down, but people who want to be tough on crime always talk about the increasing crime rate, even if they have to fake the statistics, like your president, for example.
Well, the people that push this narrative are not necessarily, or the originators of this narrative is not necessarily the politicians, but rather the people that would benefit from these type of policies being implemented. And so that's where you start going into the private prison industry, and then you would be able to see that there is a concentrated effort by these industries to amplify this narrative in order to gain profit.
Yeah, I see the private prison industry as, being faced, it's faced with an economic imperative. It gets a fixed amount of money per prisoner, so that means it wants as many prisoners as possible. 100% of your beds full would be the ideal situation for private prison. And then secondly, they have a motivation to spend less of that money. So if they can cut corners on, say, food or healthcare, that increases their profits. It's potentially, if they do everything right, if they do everything that they're supposed to do, they wouldn't make a profit. So then they wouldn't be in the business of providing prisons. If I'm correct, the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution abolished slavery almost entirely, but not while in prisons. And so can you talk about working inside a prison? What kind of work do you do? How much do you get paid, and who profits from that work?
Well, you know, when I was incarcerated, you know, I worked inside of the prison. The best job I ever had in the prison was as a tutor in the education department. But eventually the education department was phased out. And
sounds like a smart move. Right?
Yeah. And, I was transferred to a department, printing department. And so we did a lot of work for people that may have contracted with the prison for printing needs. I didn't get paid for that because I was not at the level to get paid. But those that were at the level to get paid was able to, I think, make as much as $2 a day for their efforts.
And who makes the money? Who makes the profit from this printing?
Well, so one thing I do know is that the state of Florida contracted with a company, and the company name I believe was Pride Industries. And so Pride Industries would run the program in the prison. And so, of course, there's a level of profit that Pride would automatically get. But the funny thing about this is that, you know, you work for Pride while you're in prison, but if you get out of prison and go to Pride for a job, they don't have any openings for you.
Right. I mean, you'd think a company like that might want to employ people released from prison, but I guess maybe their aim is just to make lots of money. I mean, if you can get employees at $2 a day, I mean, that's better than doing your work in Bangladesh or somewhere. I mean, that's...
But of course, and I think that's why there is some rhetoric that there are some people that believe that, you know, the big divide in America is not necessarily racism. The driving force behind the divide in America is capitalism, you know, the greediness. You know, and so if there are ways that people can make more money, they would do that. And what comes out of their attempt to do so are situations or systems that oppress poor people, that divide people according to race, you know, and socioeconomic status. And it just amplifies, you know, whatever tensions they are.
When
they benefit from that, at the end of the day, it's about how I can make the most amount of money with the least amount of work.
Right. Now, when you were working for free for this company, that's the definition of slavery. And that's what I was saying about the 14th Amendment, is it did not abolish slavery for people who were incarcerated. But how come you weren't getting even $2 a day?
Because they don't have to give me $2 a day. They don't have to give anybody $2 a day. I think, you know, when you're talking about working for free being the definition of slavery, I think I will expand on that. I think being forced to work is a definition of slavery, whether or not they gave me $2 a day. Because in prison, if you do not want to work, you're punished. You know, and so you have to work regardless of whether there's any kind of financial incentive behind it.
What would happen to you in prison if you said, I'm not going to work for free, then what?
Well, then you're going to be placed in an area where you can't get paid, and then if you don't want to work there, then you'll be disciplined and probably placed in solitary confinement, and you'll end up possibly even losing any earned gain time that you may have accumulated.
So, in other words, you won't be getting out on parole if you're not working. You will
not get out early. You're going to do 100% of your time, and most of the time that you're going to be doing is going to be in a lockup, in solitary confinement.
I mean, it's hard to compare much in the modern day to the brutality of slavery, which I think is far beyond this. I mean, punishments there were not solitary confinement. They were cruel beatings and all kinds of horrible things. But still, this is you work or you're punished, and you work for free. I mean, that is still slavery. I don't know how you put lipstick on that pig. Okay, so I mean, and how many of these prisons in Florida are private versus run by the state or the county or the federal government?
Yeah, so I think at last count, and I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think there are around 15 private facilities that are being run now. And so that's about, I would say, close to 20% of the total amount of prisons in Florida. I know in 2011 there was a big push to privatize about 78 prisons. In Florida, but that effort failed. But I wouldn't be surprised if we were to see another attempt to do so.
And are the private prisons lobbying in any way to get more people in jail? Do you know of anything like that happening?
I mean, that is something that is common knowledge in throughout the states. You know, basically with these private prisons, corporations such as GEO Group, or Correction Corporation of America, really having compact agreements or having agreements with state governments that would guarantee that a certain percentage of the prison beds are filled. And then you would see these corporations influencing elected officials that have some kind of authority to impact policies as it relates to not only just incarceration, but also to reentry as well.
Right. Well, we need to talk about that. But let's first talk about the war on drugs, because, a lot of people are put in jails in the United States, not because they beat somebody up or killed somebody or raped somebody, but because they were caught with some drugs on them, often just for personal consumption. So what can you say about the war on drugs? How is it going? Are they winning yet?
Well, they, you know, if we were fighting battles the way we fought the war on drugs, the United States, the people of the United States would be screaming for the heads of these politicians. You know, for so many years, this so-called war on drugs has been going on, and it's done nothing but destroy families. It's done nothing but put a strain on our economy. You know, and no one has benefited from this other than private industries that profit from that. This is a war. It's a war that was lost from the day it was first started, because the intentions of the war was not to combat drugs, but rather to combat a class of people. You know, and so a war on drugs is really a war on poverty. It was a war on minority communities.
I mean, one of the interesting things I think now is that the new drug problem is opiates, and these were not created by Mexican drug gangs. They're created by pharmaceutical companies, and they're not, they are impacting black communities, but they're also significantly impacting poor white communities. So we've sort of entered this new world where people are looking at drug abuse and imprisonment differently, because these are people more like them, you know, if they're...
Well, you know, I don't think that we're entering a new world with this. And the reason why I say that is because I think it's the same old system, same old, same old. When you talk about, even when you go far back as when the states first criminalized marijuana, how it was associated with the Indians and Mexicans, and how it was such a bad drug that needed to be outlawed. But at the same time, you know, you had alcohol that was thriving. When you look at even with cocaine, I mean, we knew that there was people were getting addicted to cocaine, and a lot of people that were getting addicted were white people. But that was not that big of an issue. Until when you see crack cocaine come into the picture. And then all of a sudden, because crack cocaine was mostly in the minority communities, what you've seen was disparate sentencing, you know, between crack and powder cocaine.
Do you know what the bias was? Yeah. Like, I heard like 100-1 or something. So in other words, if you got caught with powdered cocaine, you had to have like 100 times more cocaine than with crack.
To get the same sentence.
No, the same sentence, you know? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, to get the same sentence. And so now what you're seeing with this opioid addiction now that is coming to light, the thing that you see is that because it's mainly looked at as something that impacts white people, there's not a talk about having a war on opiates or locking people up. There's a talk about how do we get these people treatment, right?
Right. I mean, it's the right attitude, but it was the right attitude when it was black people on crack, right? Like, how do we get people treatment? How do we get them off the drugs and back as contributing citizens?
But like I said, at the time when you talk about the war on drugs, it wasn't the war on drugs. It was the war on minority communities, right? And so because of that, it was specifically designed to find ways to incarcerate, to demoralize, to disenfranchise a base of people that were considered a threat, right? And so the title was, it sounded good, War on Drugs, but the reality was it was more than just that.
One of the things that interests me about drugs is the thought that for a lot of people, if they're offered drugs, they're really not interested. But other people offered the same drugs will become hopelessly addicted. And I think there must be something in somebody's environment and their background and their experiences that causes that. In your personal case, have you thought about why did you start getting into trouble, start doing drugs? Were there things in your background that you know, maybe didn't cause it, but were influences on this?
You know, I think that, I mean, that's an interesting approach that you have right now, as far as with the backgrounds being a determinant factor. I know that, you know, we've seen that it's not necessarily true. You can have, you know, affluent people or poor people both be addicted, and the same could be said for both people not being addicted to a drug and alcohol. One of the stories we have with our mayor of Tallahassee, he told a story. I think it was four brothers. He had four brothers, and two brothers they all tried something, and two brothers was addicted, and the other two never tried it again.
Right.
You know, it's just I think it's a lot to do with a person's psyche at the time.
Right.
I know that, you know, when I first started, you know, it was the thing to do, a thing to experiment. You know, we look at the numbers now and we know that a vast majority of people have experimented with drugs in some form or fashion at some point in their life, some time in their life. Some of us continue on because we like it, and it's associated with fun and acceptance or whatever. Some continue on because it medicates them and helps to block out things that they don't want to think about.
I think that's true with people suffering from so-called PTSD, and that it would include a lot of soldiers, is that you can mask the pain. That's also true with people facing physical pain, which is a lot of reasons why people start on opiates. I mean, were you dealing with that, or were you just like trying to have a good time?
I was just having a good time. You know?
And it got out of control.
And eventually it did get out of control. And, you know, yeah, it just led me down a path that, you know, was not too pleasant, you know, but thankfully I was able to catch myself in time, you know, and straighten up, walk straight and narrow.
Right. Okay, so we kind of strayed a long way from this issue of voting, and I want to talk about a few other things, but I don't want to lose the thread on voting. So how are you going about getting the vote back for felons in Florida, and what kind of support are you getting in opposition?
Well, right now, there really isn't any opposition to our efforts. We're currently engaged in a citizens initiative that would place a measure on the ballot in 2018 in Florida that would allow individuals who have served their time, completed their sentence, to include parole or probation, would afford them the opportunity to register to vote and participate in elections. There are a subset of offenders that would not be included or not benefit from this measure, and those individuals who were convicted of murder or felony sexual offenses like rape, child molestation. Everyone else, however, would be able to register to vote and vote once they have successfully completed all portions of their sentence.
Okay, so if you're given a suspended 2-year sentence, you would still not be able to vote for 2 years. That would have to be successfully
completed. You would not be able to vote for 2 years.
And if you're out on parole, again, you wouldn't be able to vote until your parole was completed.
That is correct.
Okay. And so you say there's not really any opposition to this. That kind of surprises me because there's a lot of people out there who are throw them in jail and throw away the key and, you know, we don't ever want to see them again. But you're not getting a lot of pushback.
You know, not at this time, you know. And yeah, while there are some people that, you know, believe in throwing us in jail and throwing away the key, I think a vast majority of them do realize that no one is going to stay in jail forever. 95% of people who are incarcerated will return to their communities, and they realize that if we erect impediments to successful reentry, we just create an even worse situation or increase the likelihood of those individuals committing another offense and going back to prison. So we as a community and those individuals, they do understand the importance of successful reentry, and they understand the importance of public safety, and they do understand the concept of second chances and redemption.
Right. So when you left jail for the last time, and went through a process that ended up with you getting a degree in law, what assistance were you given after you left prison?
Well, you know, when the last time I left, I was given $100 and dropped off in the middle of downtown Miami to fend for my own. I immediately went to a homeless shelter, and it was there that I was able to at least start getting some type of help. And these are social programs that, you know, unfortunately, every year are on the cutting blocks of elected officials, right, either in D.C. or in our state capital. But these are vital programs towards successful reentry. You know,
And what kinds of programs did you go into that helped you?
Well, you know, one of the programs is to help people find safe and affordable housing, so they don't have to remain in the shelter. And so I was able to go through that program and find a place to stay. Another program that they have is, you know, they would identify people with substance abuse issues.
Right.
And they would get those individuals that identify or self-identify into programs, drug treatment programs, to help them deal with that addiction as well. And then another program is that, you know, particularly for homeless people, there is a lack of medical care, you know, whether it's and dental care. And so a person can go years without ever having seen a doctor or a dentist. And so they could experience a lot of medical issues that they're either unaware of or just cannot afford to deal with. And so programs that's in these places are able to get people affordable health care and really, you know, make a medical assessment of where they're at and try to help them really become healthy and live healthier lives.
That's interesting. How I would have thought that the type of people you're talking about, homeless people with no income or minimal income, would be eligible for what is it, Medicare or Medicaid, the medicine for the very poor, medical care for the very poor. Is that not the case?
Say that again.
Wouldn't people in America who are so poor that they're homeless, they don't have a job, wouldn't they be eligible for Medicaid as because of their poverty?
I mean, yes, but you know, one of the things that we understand now is that, I mean, there could be a ton of services out there for individuals, but if they don't know about it, then they can't do anything about it.
So sometimes it's as simple as filling out a bunch of forms to apply for things they could get that they didn't know.
And maybe some of those applications are confusing, you know.
Right.
And so to have an organization that would help walk people through that process, and this particular place where I was able to do that. So if an individual qualified for Medicaid or whatever, then they were walked through that process,
right?
So that they would be on they would have Medicaid, you know,
right? And then they could get their health problems dealt with. And I mean, what do you think about the current healthcare bill that could remove drug treatment from health insurance plans and reduce the number of people on Medicaid and things like that?
Oh, I'm not an expert in that. You know, that's not my area of expertise.
Okay.
But what I do believe is that the measure of a society is judged by how it treats the weakest. You know, its weakest. There's an old adage that says a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And so if we want to be a good, a stronger community, a stronger society, or even a stronger nation, that it is imperative that we commit ourselves to strengthening the weakest in our communities. And those are people who are the elderly, the poor, you know, the people that are coming back from prison and our young people.
And when you left, you said you got housing, but did you have a job? Like, how did you pay for the housing, or was this?
Yeah. So you cannot get housing without a job, right?
Right.
So the program was set up to where, you know, you would get a job, and then you had to save money, and when you were able to reach a certain threshold, you know, then you were able to put a deposit on an apartment or a house,
right?
And move in, you know. So yeah, that was part of the process.
And how did you end up going to college? Like, how did that get funded? Did you get a grant, or did you pay for that through your savings?
No, I was able to get a grant to go to college.
Right.
Yeah, I was able to do that. Yeah.
Right. I mean, to me, it seems that, you know, somebody coming out of jail who's maybe, you know, done well in prison, has behaved themselves, and, you know, there's a chance that they can reform, it seems that's a time where society should step in and help them. Because if they successfully transition to a job, to college, to being a productive member of society, they're going to end up paying back all of that money you invested in them. But if you basically throw them on the street, they're likely to end up back on drugs or dealing drugs or in some other form of crime.
I mean, I agree with you. I agree with that. And that's why it's so important, you know, especially on this issue about the restoration of rights, that the, you know, community, that the public really comes out in strong support of this, because it's a win-win situation. You know, person gets to be made whole again, and our community gets to be stronger.
I would have thought that Republicans would have been strongly against this, because 1.7 million people, what percentage of those are black or Hispanic?
Well, Well, it tickles me that you mentioned Republicans and blacks and Hispanics in the same sentence.
I'm just guessing that not a lot of them are going to vote Republican.
Well, that's two things. So let's talk about the Republican aspect of this, right? And so there's always been this narrative that Republicans are against this. And that narrative is based on, an assumption that the majority of people who are incarcerated would not vote for a Republican, right?
Yeah.
And I tell people that I kind of disagree with that to a certain degree. And the reason why is that I know that when a person is arrested, the police officer does not ask them if they're Democrat or Republican. When a person is sentenced, the judge does not ask if they're Democrat or Republican. To think that the majority of people who are incarcerated would vote Democrat, or the majority of people who can't vote will vote Democrat, is to say that only Democrats commit crimes, or only Democrats get arrested or convicted for crimes. And that is not factual. The reality is that our criminal justice system, this war on drugs, have managed to transcend racial and political lines, right? And so you have individuals who have lost their right to vote that may self-identify as conservative. Just like you have those who would self-identify as progressive. And then when we look at, the major improvements around selling different franchises over the last 10 years, what I've seen is that the loudest national voice on this issue is that of a Republican with Congressman Rand Paul. When I look at what's going on in Virginia, that effort was started by the current governor's predecessor and attorney general, who are both conservative. When you look at Florida, where one of the better policies was implemented by Governor Charlie Crist, at the time he did so, he was a conservative. And so I kind of shy away from a narrative that says Republicans are against this because, the reality is I think everyone is really impacted, whether they be Republicans or Democrats or independents.
It's very true that Democrats participated in the war on drugs and in the over-incarceration of Americans. That's very true. But what I was thinking of is that Republicans have spent a lot of effort in suppressing the vote, and a lot of that is like suppressing the vote of people whose names indicate they might be black or Hispanic. And I would imagine that of the 1.7 million former felons in Florida, more than 14% of them are black, greater than the representation in the population.
Okay, so yes, this issue definitely disproportionately impacts African Americans. However, when you look at the total amount of people, when you're talking about over 1.7 million people who cannot vote, the majority of those individuals are not black. African Americans would only account for a third of those individuals. So you have two-thirds who are not African American,
right?
And they're white. You have white Americans who are directly impacted. Particularly even white American from rural areas, and so there is, we don't shy away from the reality that this policy was originally intended to minimize or diminish the political power of the newly freed slaves. But we have to recognize that while that was its original intention, it has now grown and impacted a wide swath of people across racial and political lines.
Right.
And so this is now more of a moral human rights issue than anything else.
Right. I mean, these things tend to backfire. They're blunt tools at best. So if you succeed in 2018 and your constitutional amendment passes and most of these former felons who completed their sentences get to vote, what do you think you'll do next?
That's a good question. Maybe I can finally take a day off.
Yes.
And okay. Relax.
Let's say that's the first thing you do. But okay, on day two, after you've taken your day off, I mean, do you have other? There's a lot of things that former felons lose. You lost the right to practice law. You might lose the right to get food stamps, public housing, incredibly difficult to get a job. Like, you know, is there a number two issue that you're kind of looking at in terms of helping former felons?
Well, the number two is that what I would really focus on even more would be finding ways to really invest. Have society invest in returning citizens investing in their community. So what I believe is that individuals who have felony convictions, they have something of value to offer our society. And, and so if we can just find ways to tap into those things, that we'll be better collectively as a country. And so that would be my next focus, is how to really spend more time figuring that out. Getting these people to be mentors, and how we can have these people working on issues such as reducing gun violence, reducing school truancies, minimizing school to prison pipeline,
Right.
These are things that I believe, or even community redevelopment. These are things that I think that formerly incarcerated or formerly convicted individuals could be of a great help to our efforts.
Well, I guess I can safely say is that you will have no shortage of work if you choose to take it up. Thank you for joining me today, and I wish you all the best with your efforts, and I'll try to remember to contact you in 2018 and see how things went with you.
All right. I appreciate the invite, David. Thank you so much for having me.
And goodbye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 136 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at InfectiousMyth. You can commit to regular donations via patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.